Thanks for tuning in for the November 5th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. This week's featured interview features a discussion on more prominent muscle involvement in dermatomyositis patients with anti-MI2 autoantibodies. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear a second part of a discussion on Oliver Sacks with biographer Lawrence Weschler.
This is Stacey Clardy. Today I'm talking with Dr. Andrew Maiman. Andy leads the muscle disease unit at NIH, and he still sees patients at Johns Hopkins as well. Today we're going to discuss autoimmune myositis, and specifically his paper in the journal Neurology titled More Prominent Muscle Involvement in Those Dermatomyositis Patients with Anti-MI2 Autoantibodies. Welcome, Andy, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Stacey. Thanks a lot.
I want to start by talking about when to suspect myositis and how to approach a patient with suspected myositis in clinic, regardless of, you know, if I think I have an idea about a specific antibody. So I'm going to tell you my non-neuromuscular doc approach to myositis, and you can sort of mercilessly critique it. But in my defense, I'm more of a central nervous system doc who last had the brachial plexus memorized, maybe in detail, the day I walked out of my neurology board. So don't laugh, but just give me some tips to improve, okay?
Sounds good.
So it seems to me when I have evaluated some patients who maybe ultimately ended up with a myositis diagnosis, whether I made it or one of my colleagues did, they've come in with diffuse symptoms initially. They're the sort of patients when you're doing the review of systems, they're basically saying, listen, my everything hurts. So I tend to drill down and I'll ask if there's pain in the joint or if they think it's more in the nerves or if it's more in the muscle. And if they can tell me there's a component of muscle, I usually try to ask questions about proximal versus distal, you know, the things we're all taught about. Do you have trouble standing from a chair, going up steps, brushing your hair, lifting things above your head, that sort of thing. And if I get indicators from that questioning that it is muscle and it's proximal versus distal, I then will delve into more systemic kind of symptoms like a dyspnea or rashes or fatigue, weight loss, infections. You know, I am an autoimmune neurologist, so I sort of ask things like dry eyes, dry mouth, joint swelling, all the rheumatologic sort of things, for lack of a better term, and then a little family history as well. And then once that's all done, obviously the exam, and it seems to me that the exam can range, when I'm thinking back about patients I've had, from essentially normal to maybe some mild weakness to really profound weakness where even it's obvious to me they have some focal muscle wasting. So I guess it maybe depends where they are in the process, but the severity doesn't particularly seem to help me. So is this a reasonable approach? What else should I be asking, and what exam features should I be trying to elicit?
No, that does sound like a very reasonable approach to meeting the new patient for the first time who you think may have a myopathy or myositis. I would mention that I think that muscle weakness rather than muscle pain is usually the predominant symptom in patients with autoimmune muscle disease. There can definitely be muscle pain, and maybe a third or half of patients will have muscle pain, but it can also be painless weakness. And I also really like the questions that you asked about activity. So, you know, as you mentioned, patients who have trouble going up steps, getting up from a chair, raising their arms above the head, all these are really consistent with proximal muscle weakness, which is the typical pattern of weakness in patients with all the different forms of myositis, with the notable exception of inclusion body myositis. And I think it's important to remember that IBM patients almost always have a significant component of distal weakness. Now, they sometimes may not be aware of it, but usually you're going to bring it out in the exam, which we'll talk about in a minute. Another thing I like to ask about is whether patients are tripping or falling. This is a pretty typical initial complaint of patients who have inclusion body myositis, which is important on the differential. And they have that because there's usually weakness of the quadriceps and or ankle dorsiflexors. And that pattern of weakness and falling is an unusual initial manifestation of the other types of myositis. I also think it's important to ask about dysphagia. Patients with IBM, again, have difficulty swallowing pretty frequently, and that can occur early on. But in patients with other types of autoimmune muscle disease, like dermatomyositis and other types we'll talk about, it is unusual to have swallowing difficulty unless the myopathy is pretty severe. Another thing is to ask about things and features that would point away from a diagnosis of myositis. So one thing I always ask about are symptoms of myasthenia gravis, which can also present with symmetric proximal muscle weakness. So I'm always going to ask about double vision, droopy eyelids, weakness that fluctuates throughout the day, all those things that could point away from a typical case of myositis. I like asking about family history as well, and I think it is pretty common for patients with myositis to have a family member who has some other type of autoimmune disease. So, for example, we'll meet patients with myositis who have a family member with lupus or multiple sclerosis. But if they say they have another close family member that has myositis, that's a real tip-off that it's not myositis, that it's actually a genetic or inherited muscle disease, because it's almost unheard of to find two cases of autoimmune myositis in the same family. Another thing that I think it's important to remember, and you touched on this too, is that, you know, patients with myositis often have a multi-system disease. So in addition to the muscle, the skin, the lungs, and the joints can be commonly affected in patients with myositis. And I'm particularly interested if there's lung involvement, because about 20% of our patients have interstitial lung disease as well as the myositis. So I like to ask about cough or shortness of breath, which can be associated with interstitial lung disease. And then again, on the neurologic exam, you really want to do a good strength assessment and note the pattern of weakness in these patients. So you'll want to note whether patients have symmetric proximal muscle weakness. That's the type that's really most typical for patients who have autoimmune muscle disease. If patients have weakness of triceps, wrist flexors, and most importantly, finger flexors, then you're going to be thinking about inclusion body myositis. And in the lower extremities, inclusion body myositis patients may have hip flexor weakness, but they usually also have weak quadriceps and ankle dorsiflexors. And that might be relatively subtle. You may have to do things like have the patient try to walk on their heels to really elicit that distal weakness at the ankles. And another thing that I think it's really important to keep in mind is that in most forms of myositis, the weakness is symmetric. But in inclusion body myositis, it's pretty typical for the pattern of weakness to be asymmetric. So that's another sort of helpful hint in the physical exam. In addition to the muscles, you also really want to pay close attention to the skin. And you're going to be looking for the hallmark features of dermatomyositis, which can be subtle and you could miss it if you're not specifically looking for it. And the patient may not complain of it if it's mild. So you're going to look at the periorbital region for the heliotrope rash, which is really a pathognomonic rash for dermatomyositis. If you see this sort of purplish discoloration around the eyes, that's kind of dermatomyositis until proven otherwise. Similarly, you're going to examine the hands and look at the extensor surfaces of the hands, and you're going to be looking for Gottron's papules on the knuckles. Again, that is just a classic hallmark feature of dermatomyositis, not found in other diseases, and if you see that, again, you're looking at dermatomyositis. Other rashes, like the V-shaped rash on the chest or the shawl distribution rash on the back, you can see in dermatomyositis but are less specific than the Gottron's papules or the heliotrope rash. And another tip here is to also look at the palms of the hands. If you see ulcerating lesions on the palms of the hands, that is a very typical rash seen in dermatomyositis patients with an autoantibody against MDA5. And that's really important to know about because patients with anti-MDA5 autoantibodies have a very high risk of rapidly progressive interstitial lung disease. And that's something you want to not miss. Based really solely on the presence of a rash like that, those ulcerating lesions on the palm, I would be doing studies to look at pulmonary function, test pulmonary function, and also consider sending that patient directly to see a pulmonologist.
Okay, I think I got it. So maybe if I listen to that three times, that's sort of like equivalent to a muscle fellowship. No, that's fantastic. So that makes a lot of sense. That really fills in. I don't think in neurology, maybe in neuromuscular you do more, but I don't feel like in general neurology training, maybe we're told to look at the hands and the skin as much as we should. So that's actually a very good reminder to me as well. So let's talk about lab tests. It seems to me that some of these patients, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that I'm recalling in the past, have a normal CK level and a normal aldolase. And I remember checking that and going, well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's really not muscle I'm looking at here. So do I rely on those? Or should I maybe first pass, go right to ordering a full muscle autoantibody panel? Or should I do something in between and maybe get an ANA or something else? What's your approach to the first lab evaluation for patients that have suspicious findings?
Well, I think in my mind, I still will check the CK and aldolase, but you're absolutely right. the CK and aldolase don't have to be elevated in patients who have myositis. But if they are elevated, I think it's very helpful and really makes your diagnosis that this is at least muscle-based problem more secure. But in patients, especially with dermatomyositis, you can have really significant weakness without the CK or aldolase rising. And that's probably because in order for the CK to go up, you have to have necrosis of muscle fibers, and that allows the CK to leak out. In patients with dermatomyositis, you probably can get significant muscle dysfunction and weakness even without myofiber necrosis. So that's my explanation for why the CK and aldolase may sometimes be normal in those patients. Now, the ANA is an interesting test. It looks for antibodies against nuclear proteins. But it's important to remember that not all of the targets of the immune system in patients with myositis are nuclear. So, for example, JO1, SRP, and HMG-CoA reductase are all cytoplasmic proteins. So you won't necessarily pick those up in an ANA screen. So I do think that in a patient where you really suspect they have some form of myositis, ordering a panel of myositis autoantibodies early is probably a good idea.
Okay. So with that in mind, is there any reason to get muscle biopsy on these patients in the modern era of all this serologic testing?
Well, that is a great question. It's a highly controversial question, and I'm sure that many of your listeners, many experts out there may have differing opinions, but I can give you what my personal opinion is, kind of what my personal approach is. And I think there are three situations where you probably do want to get a muscle biopsy. The first would be patients who have suspected myositis but don't have a classic dermatomyositis skin rash and who do not have a myositis-specific autoantibody. Now, it may be that it's just going to take you too long to get the myositis autoantibody panel back. And so that's a situation where, again, the biopsy may help you to make the diagnosis. The second would be when you've got a case of suspected inclusion body myositis, but you're not sure. In that case, if you do a muscle biopsy and you see focal invasion of myofibers by T cells or rimmed vacuoles on the muscle biopsy, that's really going to help confirm your suspicion for inclusion body myositis. Another reason to think about getting a muscle biopsy would be if your patient is thinking about joining a clinical trial that requires a muscle biopsy diagnosis to enter the trial. So again, those are the, I think, three reasons, and you can probably think of a couple more, where getting a muscle biopsy is really going to help you or the patient.
Got it. Okay. So, I mean, really, if I can nail it down on my clinical exam, clinical features that are pathognomonic and positive serologic results, I wouldn't be remiss to skip the muscle biopsy. Is that fair?
In my view, that's exactly right. The reason to do a muscle biopsy is if it's going to help you make a diagnosis or make some sort of prognostication about the patient. And in many cases, that's just not the case. And I would argue that the myositis autoantibodies probably give you more diagnostic information and more information about how that patient's going to do than a muscle biopsy currently can.
Got it. This does bring up one more perhaps naive question for me. You've been using the term dermatomyositis a lot. What's the difference between polymyositis and dermatomyositis? I remember back in med school being told that the difference was with dermatomyositis, you had skin involvement. So I don't know if that was an oversimplification or if that's still true. And does one have more prognostic value, one of these labels?
So you bring up another very controversial question, which is about the difference between polymyositis and dermatomyositis, and what exactly is polymyositis anyway. So in my opinion, and again, you will find people have other opinions, but in my opinion, I think we now recognize that there are really five main types of myositis. There's dermatomyositis, which is when patients have myositis plus the typical skin rash of dermatomyositis. There's the antisynthetase syndrome, where patients have myositis and one of the antisynthetase autoantibodies. And those patients, again, will often also have interstitial lung disease and or arthritis. You have patients with immune-mediated necrotizing myopathy, where the classic muscle biopsy feature is necrosis and the typical autoantibodies are those recognizing SRP or HMG-CR. You've got inclusion body myositis, which we've talked about. And then you have overlap myositis. So those would be patients who have myositis along with some other connective tissue disorder like lupus or scleroderma, for example. There's actually a sort of classic paper, if you go back to a 2003 issue of Neurology, in an editorial by Tony Amato and Birch Griggs. They titled that editorial, Unicorns, Dragons, Polymyositis, and Other Mythological Beasts. And they really sort of capture, I think, what my current thinking about polymyositis is. And they really arrived at that about 15 years ago. And I think the rest of us are just catching up.
Got it. I'm going to go look that up. So this leads me to my next question, because you're starting to talk about all these different types of antibodies. The paper specifically that you just published is about dermatomyositis associated with MI2 antibodies. So how common is that subtype, and how do I know when to suspect it? Would I specifically see something that would make me order only MI2 antibodies, or am I still going to do the screen with all of them?
So I think that in most cases, it probably makes sense to order the whole panel of dermatomyositis autoantibodies. One of the interesting things about the anti-MI2 positive dermatomyositis patients is that they seem to have more severe muscle involvement. So they were weaker than dermatomyositis patients without that antibody, and their CK levels were markedly higher than patients without the anti-MI2 autoantibody. Now, the good news is that with typical standard treatments, almost all of those patients had resolution of their muscle weakness and normalization of their CK. So those patients really did well in terms of the muscle disease. And another piece of good news, I think, for patients who are anti-MI2 positive is that they don't seem to have the increased risk of cancer that patients with the TIF1 gamma and anti-NXP2 autoantibodies have. And they also don't have an increased risk of interstitial lung disease or a real risk for developing calcinosis, which can be a really devastating complication of dermatomyositis that occurs especially in patients who are positive for anti-NXP2 autoantibodies.
Got it. And you mentioned sort of the usual immunosuppressants. Can you tell us what are the usual immunosuppressants that you employ, and how long do you usually recommend treating these patients until you try to taper off?
Sure. So in most cases, steroids are our first-line treatment for these patients. And, you know, you always are going to adjust the dose depending on how severe the disease is. But in most dermatomyositis patients, I'm going to start at a dose of 1 mg/kg of corticosteroids. Now, in our experience, most patients with dermatomyositis are going to require some form of chronic immunosuppression. And we don't like to use high-dose steroids for very long. So in order to taper the steroids, I'm usually going to start a steroid-sparing agent right away. And there are a number you could choose from. The typical ones would be methotrexate, azathioprine, or mycophenolate. And exactly which one you choose can depend on a number of factors. In patients with refractory disease who don't respond to one of the oral agents, we most usually will use something like IVIG or rituximab.
Thank you again, Andy, for taking time to discuss myositis in general and your approach, as well as your most recent paper on MI2 antibody subtype dermatomyositis. I'll keep looking in the future to see your group's work. I know that you've been characterizing several. I saw the RMP one earlier this year, so I do appreciate you walking us through each of these and helping us to not miss them.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I apologize if there is a bit too much alphabet soup there. Nothing that a simple table won't help explain.
Thank you.
In the second segment of the podcast, we're picking back up with part two of our interview with Lawrence Wechsler. He is not only a biographer of Oliver Sacks, but also his lifelong friend. And because of that relationship, he is able to share with us wonderful insights on one of the most famous neurologists of our time. We started this second half of the interview discussing the fear of stigma and discrimination that Dr. Sacks faced because he was gay. Here's what Lawrence had to say when I asked his thoughts on what effect this had on Oliver's life and ultimately how he practiced medicine.
It's a tormented and tormenting story. He was gay. He was deeply, deeply closeted at the time that I was with him. The basic arc of what had happened is that he had realized that he was gay early on. As I mentioned to you before, both of his parents were doctors. They were Orthodox Jews, by the way. His mother was one of the first female surgeons in England, OBGYN surgeon. And when he was 18, 19, 20-something, he came back from Oxford, and his father said, you know, you never bring any girls home. And he said, Father, I'm a homosexual. Please don't tell Mother. It would destroy her. By the way, I should say he was not practicing. He was still a virgin at that point. Anyway, the next morning his mother came down and tore into him for 3 hours of, as he called it, deuteronomical cursings, how he was an abomination, the filth of the bowel, and then, you know, biblical verse culminating in, "I wish you had never been born." This from the person who was the most important person in his life at that point. They had a very close relationship. She then fell silent, and they didn't talk to each other for weeks. And when they resumed talking, it was never talked about again in her lifetime. He fled eventually to California. And for 3 years, he was a resident first in San Francisco and then at UCLA. And he lived a flamboyantly, wildly sexual, druggy life. He was in motorcycle gangs. He was a heavyweight lifter. He was a bodybuilder. He was very much into the leather scene. But more than anything else, he was just having extravagant drug usage, which was all of a piece with the whole thing. And then one day he looked at himself in the mirror and said, "You know, if I keep this up, I'll be dead in 6 months." And pretty much over the next year, he quit everything cold turkey. He quit the drugs, but more amazingly, he just became celibate. When I met him, he had been celibate for 15 years. He would remain celibate for 35 years altogether. Not that he wasn't constantly falling in love and being fallen in love with, he just wasn't allowing anything to happen. He insisted that the homosexuality had nothing to do with his science. He considered being a homosexual during those years the blight of his existence. He wished it wasn't the case. He was completely unaffected by gay liberation. Even though he was deep in psychoanalysis, and his analysts used to say, "You are the least affected by gay liberation of anybody I know." Even though at the time that the Stonewall Rebellion took place, his apartment was two or three blocks from Stonewall. And yet that happened to be the very summer where the Awakenings thing was climaxing in 69. And so he kind of was oblivious to that. He was at Beth Abraham 22 hours a day and sleeping on cots at Beth Abraham and never going home. In any case, he had absolutely cut that part of him off. It is richly coincidental that that's when he has his leg accident and loses the feel of having a leg. It's not hard to make Freudian associations with that. But in any case, he felt, when he asked me, "Is there any way you can tell the story without reference to the homosexuality?" I insist that homosexuality has nothing to do with my science. It is of no bearing whatsoever. And what I felt was that there was no way of understanding him without that. Not so much the homosexuality itself. I used to say to him, "Oliver, nobody cares. You know that, don't you? Nobody cares." This being, you know, the early 80s, and certainly in places like New York and San Francisco and so forth, there wasn't that kind of stigma as much as he imagined there to be. Although, of course, there still was some. But it wasn't the homosexuality, but it was his own attitude to it being such a blight. And even more importantly, one had to be able to write about the drug experiences he'd had, which were epic. He took 10 times the amount of speed that would kill anybody else, but because he was so strong, he would get on his motorcycle and motorcycle from Los Angeles to Crater Lake and back without stopping except for gas, like 36 hours, you know. He would do things like that. And I am convinced that it was because of those drug experiences and the ferocity with which he got into that thing that he was able to relate to, for example, the Awakenings patients and to imagine that they might have life going on inside their statue-like experiences because he himself had been there. He was able to relate to them also because they were part of the community of the refused, as he saw himself as being. And there was no way of writing about the drug stuff without, it would have sounded just like he was a maniac if you didn't understand what he was struggling with during those years. Right. So indeed, I felt I couldn't write it, and so he asked me not to write it.
And it almost would have been more of a fiction, right? Essentially not.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, if you're going to describe who he was, despite his denying it, he was at his core a deeply closeted, conflicted, knotted up person, who was in turn, partly because of that, able to relate to conflicted, knotted up people at moments of their extremity.
Right. And a lot of our listeners are clinicians. So what would you hope that they take away from this book? And more specifically, what's the most important message we need to take away from Oliver's life to impact our patients?
I guess it comes back to this business of, and I don't think it's as much the case today as it was when Oliver was, you know, starting out, but get your head out of the chart. Look the patient in the eye and slow down and deal with the particulars of this person. Oliver would sometimes talk about the neurology of the soul. He was half tongue-in-cheek when he said this, but the other half decidedly not. that neurology of all things was dealing with the particular history, the particular life, the particular essence of the person in front of them, the particular fears and terrors. But also, I guess this is another thing I'd point out, is one of the things he used to say to me is the patient is always right, that the privilege of the doctor is to be a student, to listen to the patient, and then to help work things out with the patient. One of the nurses said to me, for example, that even though Oliver was Jewish and he would go to these little sisters' places, which are Catholic homes, she described a particular patient who had lost the ability to hold her rosary beads in her hand. And he came up to this nun and said to her one day, would it be okay if we glued the rosaries to like a ruler? Because she could hold a ruler. And would that be allowed, you know? And this was, made a huge difference in this person's life. There was a patient who used to insist that he was standing upright, even though he was at a 45-degree angle all the time. And so the two of them together came up with the idea of figuring out a way to have a level, a carpenter's level, you know, the little bubble thing, and glasses in a way that the person could see them and write themselves accordingly and so forth. They were continually coming up with extremely practical things, but based on, you know, really spending time talking to the patient. I'll just give you one other example. This was extremely early in his career. There was a case of, I believe, Gerald, the tea planter. He was still a resident, I think, at Middlesex Hospital in London, right after he, or just as he was finishing his Oxford medical degree. And this was a patient who was completely delirious. He was suffering from a uremic delirium, I think is what it was called. Oliver would go in there and spend hours, all night, all the next day, 36 hours straight, entering the patient's delirium, listening to the delirium and beginning to make sense of it and then becoming part of it, and they would take part in together. All the other doctors that they would pass is, oh, God, there goes Oliver again. You know, what the hell is he doing? What he was doing was what Oliver described as the most privileged experience of his life, that he was able both to learn deep, deep truths about what delirium is like and what it is, but also that he was able to bring a measure of surcease, of solace to the man, that he wasn't completely alone. Now, of course, you can't do this with everybody, but you could. I mean, it's easy for me to say, I'm not a neurologist and I don't have all the pressures of the practice, but it seems to me that if you even reorient yourself a little bit in this direction, and it seems to me this is what the book in general is trying to memorialize about Oliver, that that is a way that you could be a more powerful and dynamic doctor.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You telling those stories reminds me. We did interview Oliver Sacks on the podcast in the past. It was actually right after he published The Mind's Eye, and that was in October 2010. We actually replayed them then in August 2015. And he was quite iconic by that time. He had become the people's neurologist. And
also the neurologist of 70% of the young people applying to do neurology residencies at Columbia. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable how much impact he had. And that's all for the good and needs to be preserved, it seems to me.
This has been a great discussion. But what else didn't we cover? What else do we need to know?
The other thing is just that his life, especially his childhood and his formation, and I guess another thing I would say is how funny he was. He was very aware of how odd and difficult and strange he was, and he would be the butt of his own jokes constantly. Going on museum walks with him, I mean, the whole naturalist side of him and so forth, he savored the marvel of the world, the beauty of the world, the beauty of chemistry and so forth, and yet could do it with enormous good humor. And so part of what's in the book is just what it's like to hang out with him. And boy, that was an experience, let me tell you. And it became for me a 40-year ride. And it's one of the great, great blessings of my life.
You do capture that. When I was reading the book, I could feel the tension. I could feel the tension when you were describing these bad periods in his life. And I felt as if I was you, sort of the fluctuations of just a day with him and the tension of what that involved and the humor and yet the pain that was in there as well. I think that's captured in the book. And so thank you, Lawrence, for talking with us. The book, again, is titled, And How Are You, Dr. Sacks?
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on large variation in effects during 10 years of enzyme therapy in adults with Pompe disease, and a contemporary issues article on emergency management of status epilepticus in a high-fidelity simulation. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.